Welcome back to another brand new episode of Two Please. Once again, a very hot episode of Two Please. I'm your host, Abin.
And I'm your co-host, Rohit.
We are back again for another two-parter. So a couple of years ago, I think, okay, so really generally the whole idea for this came to be was, it's been 3 years since, by the time this episode comes on, it is going to be the 3-year anniversary of Two Please. We began mid-April of 2021. We are going to be in mid-April of 2024. And somehow, miraculously, this thing has been running. So we thought we'll do like a tribute act for the first 1 month of when we were just giving a bunch of topics on various films, and primarily that were theme-based. So once again, after having a lot of feedback for the first episode the last episode that we'd done, where we'd done junk food films, I reached out to a community and they came back with films that really scared the shit out of them as adults as well as teenagers. So we'd done an episode prior, which was the Monsters Under Our Bed episode back in 2021. So you could consider this to be the spiritual sequel to it.
And I'll empathize with studio executives who keep greenlighting sequels, right? I can see how that entire situation plays out. Probably you have a KRA of, you have to make X movies, you have to put out X movies in a year. And then somewhere midway when they're lagging behind, they're like, oh shit, fine, we don't have a plan. Let's just make a sequel for that. We already have the IP, let's build on it.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what we keep bad-mouthing them. That's exactly what we're doing.
We're hypocrites. We're all hypocrites in our own way. But somehow, like, it seems to, from a feedback perspective, these episodes do work, and there's a great love for it and appreciation for these episodes. So we keep doing them. Whatever the community says, we will obviously do it for them. Of course, there is stuff for us that we do as well. Rohit is famous for it. I am famous for it. But this is purely for the community. We love you guys. Let's start the show.
So standard 3-3.
Standard 3-3. Yes. Yeah. But there are some honorable mentions that we have for this week's episode. Rather like stuff that we'd asked the community and then they sent a bunch of answers. So kind of let's just go through a couple. So we asked the community generally, what were some of the films and TV shows that scared the shit out of you as a child? And a lot of the responses were kind of the things we discussed in the first episode. So a lot of people said Aahat, which we kind of spoke about on the first episode. It was for many of us, I think we're a little older, so the Z-horror show was that initial scary television show for all Indian kids that scared the crap out of them, including that stupid theme. But Aahat, I'd probably guess, is what people remember because it was just a lot more modern. And it came up at the time when all of us could remember shit like that, right? Yeah. So Aahat was definitely there. Temple of Doom, I think we've spoken about this on prior episodes. My sister was the one that came back with it and said, dude, it scared the crap out of me. And another friend of ours, Tanmay, said Signs and Sixth Sense. Signs, I think, is a great
shout.
Great shout. Two-thirds of that film is absolutely batshit scary. And then personally, the climax doesn't work for me. That whole bat-swinging nonsense that happens in the end.
It's too watered down.
Yeah. It's not something I'm a particularly big fan of. Sixth Sense, dude, absolutely 100%. That film is frightening as hell.
Again, we covered this in Plot Twists, if I remember correctly.
Yes. Yeah. I was wondering where it is, but yeah, like all of these movies we're going to be talking about, we have spoken about it in passing somewhere or the other. We've been doing this for 3 years, so please forgive us if we have retread on a certain topic. The Exorcism of Emily Rose. Now, this kind of made Rohit's list when we were discussing what the 3v3 format was going to be. Again, this is what a horror movie masquerading as a courtroom drama. One of Scott Derrickson's, the director, one of his other films is on my list. I guess you'll have to wait and see.
Oh, I didn't know this was Scott Derrickson. That makes a lot of sense. It is a surprisingly scary movie. I remember, apart from the main reveal of the demons in Emily Rose towards the end, even there's a scene in her college dorm, which is, I know, those scenes are vivid in my memory. Again, great shot. That is a genuinely scary.
Well, Jennifer Carpenter, no? I keep calling her Deborah Carpenter.
Yes.
Deborah is what character she plays
Deborah
on.
Morgan.
Deborah Morgan. So, no, it's just, I think what Tom Wilkinson, Jennifer Carpenter, and Laura Linney. And I think it's based on the, it's supposed to be based on a true story, right? Or the exorcism.
Annalise Michelle. Yeah.
Yes. So again, there's a lot of courtroom drama, but there's every time you're just like, oh, courtroom drama, you kind of relax, the horror element kicks in again, and you're back up again. So it's just, it's a very unnerving, but a really riveting experience. The other shouts included Ghostbuster 2. And for a friend of the podcast, Fala, said he didn't bathe for a week because of the slime monster in the bath. I get it. That it was creep, was very creepy imagery as a kid. I think for me personally, that wasn't as scary because I, for some reason or the other, seen the whole the blood sequence from Nightmare on Elm Street. For those of you who know what I'm talking about, that's in the bedroom where like Freddy shows up in this guy's dream and there's an explosion of blood in the bedroom. That terrified me. So the slime bath was kind of like child's play compared to it. If you want to know how I ended up seeing that as a six-year-old, blame my family. We have discussed this in explicit detail on the Monsters Under Our Bed episode. Do check that out if you haven't heard it yet. Woe. I have not seen Woe, but I heard a lot of people speak about it. This is the Indian remake of It. Again. So, but I have not seen it. People said it kind of terrified them. Anaconda, again, popped up. Mukdi, which is a favorite. I mean, 2003, Shabana Azmin dressed up as a witch. Vishal Bharadwaj, again, quite terrifying. I remember being really creeped out by it.
Somebody said
the Cowardly. Yeah. You know what? Actually, they're not wrong. Because as a 10-year-old, watching The Ox for the first time really scared the shit out of me.
The right only scene that scares me is the spider. I don't know the name. Spider.
Shelob.
Yeah.
No, but then I remember watching a lot of things in the theater and being terrified of the Uruk-hai. Just, I don't know, I was 10 years old, man. I get where she's coming from.
I remember being terrified by the mediocrity of the movies.
Oh God, here we go again. No, not again. I will not get sucked into this argument.
Okay. And the same person has also said Courage the Cowardly Dog.
Yeah.
Especially the Ramsey's episode, legit scary. The rest, I mean, there are a couple. I remember the alien chicken as a kid. I was like, okay, this is more scary, less funny. The Ramsey's episode is straight up scary. There is absolutely nothing funny about it.
Return the slab.
What?
Return the slab or suffer my curse.
Ugh.
But anyway, these are some of the honorable mentions.
Yes.
We have each of our three movies. Abhin, you want to start things off?
Yes. Okay, I'll start mine off. Now, I kind of wanted to keep this as broad-based as possible. These are films. I'm still a wuss when it comes to horror films. But the curiosity always gets the better of me. And I'm always checking out things that scare the pants off of me. And very recently, as of last year, I watched a movie called When Evil Lurks. It's an Argentine horror film. And it's set in this small town where two brothers investigate a disturbance in the night. And they end up finding this cottage where they find an old lady living with her two children, and one of the children is possessed by this devil, like basically their version of the Antichrist, and he's about to be born. And if he's not disposed of in the correct manner, they risk unleashing that evil onto the town. And that's kind of what happens. And it just turns into this absolute insane situation, right? This is probably one of the meanest horror films I've seen in a very long time. It's about 90 minutes. It's plagued with bad decisions like most horror films are, but it is just so brutal and so unforgiving. And it has some extremely haunting imagery. Now I'm just thinking about it, and there's this one scene that sticks out. Everybody has a scene in this film that really bothers them. There's a scene between a dog and a girl. There's a scene between a mother and her young child. And I'm not going to like get into details about it. I highly recommend you go check this out. It's just so mean and so sad. And at the end of the film, you just feel hopeless. But no jump scares, nothing, no traditional horror tropes. It's just one possessed or an entity that's screwing with this town and just basically showcasing its power and saying there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. If you haven't seen it, you should go check this out. It's streaming, I think, on Prime now.
I just, and while you were talking, I quickly Googled because I had an Argentinian horror film.
Yeah.
My interest. And it's on Prime, so it's accessible.
Mm. So it came out, I think it was a Shudder release. So it came out on Shudder last year, and then I watched it on Prime. And I have made my friends since watch it. Rohit will have to watch it in his own time because of this arrangement in his house. But yeah. This is a film, if you really want to get those nerves going, something for you to check out.
I will. Nice. Getting things off to an appropriately terrifying start. The movie I want to talk about is a movie that we mentioned earlier in passing on one of the episodes. But I wanted to spend a little more time on it, tell our listeners more about it. Because again, every time we mention this movie, Abhin and I have, I think without fail, unfailingly said, please watch this. So true. I just wanted to spend more time on it to reiterate that message. I'm talking about the 2016 Korean horror film, The Wailing, directed by...
Na Hong Jin.
And so the premise of the movie, it's set in rural South Korea. So, it is rural. It's not even a small town. It's proper. It's a South Korean village. And there's a newcomer, this old, slightly off-putting Japanese guy that comes into town. And people are curious as to, who is he? What is he here for? And strange happenings start taking place. In the village, there is this bumbling policeman who is in charge of the investigation to try and get to the bottom of what's happening. This guy is actually a source of a surprising amount of comic relief in the movie, right? There is, I kind of remember laughing out loud twice or thrice in what is otherwise an unflinching horror film, right?
Yes.
So there's this cop who's trying to get to the bottom of this, and slowly you start seeing this malevolent force poison the people of the town, especially a handful, 2-3 of them are especially susceptible to it. And like I said, it's a slow burn in the vein of a Rosemary's Baby. It's a slow burn in the way of a lot of good horror films, right? Where the premise is at the outset clarified, but nothing confirms suspicions. Everything, it alludes to a yes or a no. So throughout the film, you're questioning yourself, right? It's like, is it? Isn't it? What do I buy into? And that uncertainty adds to your unease while you watch the film. And this is one of those movies, right? I was reading a Reddit thread the other day. What are movies that go from 0 to 100 in the last 15 minutes or in the last 10 minutes? And most good slow burns fall under that category. In fact, while The Wailing wasn't on that list, another movie that was probably the top answer was Hereditary. And that's something we've discussed before. A classic slow burn that goes 0 to 100. The Wailing is in that vein. The last 15 minutes of the movie are genuinely scary, right? And as an aficionado, I have watched my fair share of horror films. Probably the last couple of years, I've been sort of put off of them because I think I'm getting older now. I'm just like, I don't want my heartbeat to quicken. But up until that point, I was really into horror films, writing horror, reading horror. So, and this is like, I don't scare easy as much because I'm a seasoned veteran and stuff. Again, it's not the jump scares. I think Wailing has one or two jump scares. So it's not the jump scares. It's just slow burns do that to you, right? It builds that unease, that pressure inside you. And if the last act is not handled well, the release of that pressure is anticlimactic. But if the last act is handled well, that release amplifies the whatever discomfort you have. And Wailing does that perfectly. I was just like, what the fuck is happening?
I think with Wailing, it's just because the first hour of this film plays like a comedy.
Yeah.
It plays like a comedy, and there are horror elements sprinkled into it.
Yes.
Then at some point during the film, right, it flips and it turns into full-blooded horror because you're kind of, it eases you into that false sense of security where you're just like, okay, it's not going to be as scary. But then it, when it turns the tables on you and you're just like, shit, what Psych. Happened? Yeah. And then it starts to build and escalate and it gets gory and it gets sad. And there's rituals that come into play. And then obviously there are twists involved. There's the whole implication that whatever's being implied with regards to the old man, is he truly a demon? Is he not? What is his whole thing into it? Families are being torn apart. The cop is slowly losing his mind. It just starts to build and ramp up in tension. And the release at the end, you just feel empty. A good horror film, and I've spoken about this in most places, is our films that hook onto you and they just don't let go. The Wailing is a classic example of it. It's a very long film. I think it's near about 3 hours. I could be wrong, or if not more, but just about around the 3 hour mark. I suggested this to a friend and they said, oh, for 2 hour, 45 minutes, I need to read subtitles. I was like, okay, fine. It's not the most accessible to a general audience. But dude, this, if there is in the last decade, The Wailing is easily in my top five horror. If not, I mean, the Hereditary to me I consider it to be the best horror film in the last 10, maybe even 20 years. Yeah. I don't think you will find a horror film better than Hereditary, but The Wailing comes pretty damn close.
But yeah, that was my first movie. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to the next one.
Yeah. So moving on very quickly, I want to talk about this film. I don't know. This is a film that has garnered a fair amount of hate. I watched it about 3-4 nights ago again. And when I watched it, I really liked it. Now, a lot of people would have said growing up that they watched the genesis of this film's franchise. And to this day, many consider it to be the ultimate sci-fi horror, that being Alien. 1979's Alien.
79.
Directed by Ridley Scott. But I am one of the few people, I won't say one of the few people, I mean, I'll get to that point, but my access to Alien, having grown up as a 90s kid, funnily enough, was through the AVP games, and then through Alien vs. Predator, and then you've dripped down towards Alien, Aliens, Alien 3, Alien Resurrection, right? But I hadn't watched Aliens or Alien Resurrection prior to having watched Prometheus. I think Prometheus, which is the film I'm going to talk about, was the one that really got me hooked onto the franchise. Directed by Ridley Scott and written by Damon Lindelof, who is one of my favorite writers working in Hollywood. It is almost like a spiritual prequel to the Alien franchise. It's set a couple of years prior to whatever happens with Ripley and her ship. And it's very philosophical in its approach. It is filled with plot holes galore, some very stupid decisions, but it's what, 2 hours long, just under over 2 hours, and it's a very riveting watch. It tells the story of these guys who are sent to search for life on a particular planet. The film opens up with this guy sacrificing himself, this engineer kind of character sacrificing himself so that his DNA flows into the water and humanity springs forth from it. So that's kind of how the film's premise begins. But then there's a lot of, like, much like Damon Lindelof, he kind of lets the audience fill in the gaps. So this is the kind of movie that once you finish watching, you go back and have ready discussions about, okay, what did that mean? What did this mean? That's the kind of film where it keeps things going. Not to say it doesn't work even like as a standalone piece, right? The horror elements in this film are great. Noomi Rapace, I don't know how you pronounce her name.
Yeah.
Is a phenomenal lead in this film. The movie is populated with the most famous people you know working today. It has Noomi Rapace, Idris Elba, Charlize Theron, Sean Harris, Rafe Spall, Benedict Wong, Michael Fassbender, of course, who's the big central character, the guy who plays David, the android. You name it. It has Guy Pearce as Wayland. He's there in a blink and miss role. So you name it. They're in this movie, right? And it has some terrifying imagery. Like Alien, of course, is the birthplace of like really dark, disgusting horror. But Prometheus is a very, for me personally, a very engaging experience that both terrified me. There's a whole Caesarean scene that takes place where Elizabeth Shaw, Noomi Rapace's character, has to remove the fetus growing inside her. And she unfortunately can't do it because the machine is ill-equipped to handle female pregnancies. So it's just, and it's disgusting. It's really unnerving. The alien creatures in it, the xenomorphs don't really show up, but there are like variants of it that show up. I personally find the film to be a lot of fun. In spite of the, it's not a perfect film by any stretch of the imagination, but still for me, I find it to be quite entertaining. I don't know if you've seen it.
I haven't, but I actually want to use this occasion to quickly share my point of view about my point of view on why I feel horror films should not be a franchisee, right? We shouldn't have horror franchisees, especially ones that rely on minimalism. And I would say most horror films are, the lesser you explain, the greater the impact, right? Because, and that's exactly what worked for the 1979 Alien as well. It's the minimalism of the story. People are on a ship, alien attacks ship, people have to survive alien. Strictly speaking, you don't need to know what planet it came from, what their culture was, what are their motivations. Their motivation is to propagate by killing somebody. That's it, right? And the more you demystify the mythos of your core horror IP, you water down its impact. This is my point of view, right? I'm sure people will, and everyone's free to disagree. But that's what I feel. And to take an example from a different genre, we are seeing this play out live in the case of John Wick, right?
Yeah.
Why the first John Wick worked so well is there was enough mystique, or there was just about enough revealed about him, but there was so much mystique. And when you put people in that position, whatever our brains project to fill in those gaps will always be scarier, will always be more exciting, will always be more alluring than what writers can come up with, right? And therefore, when you are shown less, the gaps you, that you fill in your own way make the movie viewing experience a lot better. But as in when you start building these sequels, you need, you can't just rehash the same thing, right? You have to add something, bring something more to the table. And most often, more often than not, that something more to the table comes in the form of exposition. You either flesh out the world or you flesh out characters if you're retaining them across films. Or you flesh out the core horror concept, right? You talk more about their motivations, their origins, blah, blah, blah. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. You're going to get different movies. You're not going to be able to replicate the magic of the original.
Yeah, I think as long as you don't try to replicate the magic, the film series works. Now, coming back to the John Wick point, personally, I am not a fan of, let's say, one John Wick film out of the four that have now come out. I am not the biggest fan of 3. I think 3 was the one where I felt the most fatigue. And I am fine with the expansion of the world as long as you don't repeat the same tropes twice. Now, if you ask me my favorite film in the Alien franchise, it's not the first one, it's the second one. And the Aliens. Second one is Aliens. And it is, it's not a horror film. The first one is, of course, like, the second one is an action film. Similarly, with Terminator 1 and 2, I think somebody mentioned this as a film that really scared them. Terminator 1 is a horror film for the most part. It's one man chasing this woman, and because she has... Terminator 2 is undoubtedly the better film, but it's not a horror movie. There are elements of horror in it. Like, you take, for instance, the T-1000. The T-1000 is a fucking terrifying character. And he's played so well. Robert Patrick, who showed up on The Sopranos, and I was just like, in a completely different, like 180, he plays a sympathetic loser, and you see him as the T-1000 in Terminator 2, where he's just terrifying.
Oh, by the way, I was that reminds me that I was recently watching the Reacher TV show on Amazon Prime. Second season has Robert Patrick in this antagonist role, and one of the team members from Jack Reacher's team uses the code name Sarah Connor. And so Robert Patrick's team member is like, somebody is used this code name Sarah Connor. Do you know what Sarah Connor is referring to? And Patrick Connor is like, Robert Patrick is like, I don't give a shit who that is. And so that's it, I'm like, hey.
Oh, dude. I'm a big fan of T2. I think we all are. And we've spoken about it at some point.
And both Aliens and T2 is James Cameron. So
James Cameron, yeah.
He just came in, like, made the second, he also made Terminator 1, but whatever. He switched up genres in the second film. What parts 1 were horror in both cases. switch it up to action, and probably general
for the better, right?
Be for the better.
Yeah, I mean, Aliens 3 is one of my favorite directors working, but of course, we all know the shit show that happened with David Fincher. But
David Fincher, the director of Gone Girl.
Yes. Confirmed. This can't be a two-piece episode without the mention of Gone Girl. I think we should make it a thing. Every episode.
How can we show
what is this movie's connection to Gone Girl?
6 degrees of Gone Girl.
Six degrees of Gone Girl. Oh, we just birthed a segment. Lovely. Okay. So, but anyway, coming back to Alien and just generally sequelitis, right? So for me, why Prometheus works, and I didn't quite like the sequel to it, Alien Covenant, where it plays off like a straight up horror film, right? I think there is Alien Romulus that's releasing a couple of months from now. And
what is happening?
It's not. I think Romulus, it's.
But Alien Maximus, Alien Aurelius. What's the plan here?
I think it's, but it's by this fellow. What's his name, dude? Fede Alvarez. And I'm a big fan of Fede Alvarez's Evil Dead. I really like Evil his Dead. Version of Evil. Yeah. I think he's also, Don't Breathe is also him.
Yes. That also is a, let's keep it. I don't want to discuss it. Again, you'll say we mentioned it in this episode. And
No. We are, I explicitly remember making this moment to make, I'm taking this moment to make a point that we are not when talking about Don't Breathe.
Yes.
But yeah, my point being, especially with why Prometheus works, and getting back to this, is because there's a fair amount of ambiguity that leaves you with wanting more. It's like even with Alien, when you first watched the film and you didn't know much about the character, you wanted to know more, but you didn't don't want to spoil the mysticism or the mystique behind the character, right? Like, who is this dildo devil that keeps popping up? And face-hugging people. And I guess that's why Prometheus, when it doesn't showcase a lot of that horror, the horror just comes from people's bad decisions and realizing why the engineers were choosing to do what they did makes for much more engaging viewing. Unraveling that puzzle is probably the most entertaining part of it.
Yeah. I guess. I mean, I'm definitely going to give it a watch at some point. I also want to spend a quick minute on what is this demon that's holding Ridley Scott hostage and like forcing him to pump out a movie every 2 years. Dude's in his 80s.
No, he just wants to do shit.
Calm down.
He's just like, I get bored and I want to make movies. And One Out of Three would be very good. I think the last Ridley Scott film I really enjoyed was The Last Duel. I don't know if you've seen it, but...
I saw it. It is.
It has Matt Damon in a French accent, which is
this is weird. It's a weird film, and it has Ben Affleck playing a king. It's just weird. Adam Driver wrote it, but he always is. But
They both wrote it, did they not?
Yeah, I think so.
But yeah, I think we've spoken about this, and I think those kind of movies generally don't get made a lot these days. They usually buy a pix. Yeah, and. Like, even I was watching The Talented Mr. Ripley the other day. I haven't seen a movie like that in ages.
True. There's a show on it that's come out.
Yeah, but then again, it is an IP of a film that has already been made, right? It's not like an original IP that's popped out.
True. Andrew Scott as Ripley. Intriguing. I don't know if I'll watch it.
Intriguing, yeah.
But anyways, we digress.
Let's move on.
We digress. Okay, I want to quickly get into my second film, which is 2014's It Follows. If I recall correctly, it has, a bunch of not-so-famous actors. It's a fairly low-budget film, probably the director's debut, although don't quote me on that, I'm not sure. But the basic premise of the film is essentially when someone has sex, there is this curse that is passed on to them, and... there's this kind of monster. I don't know if it's a monster, it's a ghoul, or it's this shape-shifting creature which can take the appearance of anybody around you, known person to you or unknown to you, right? And all it does is, this monster doesn't run. It has no guile. right? All it does is it just walks at like a regular pace and it keeps following you. It will follow you 24/7, you know, day, night, whatever, wherever you are, until if it catches you, it will kill you, right? And if you die, the person who the curse was on last, as in the person who had sex with you, then becomes this creature's target. And the way you can avoid the curse is to have sex with another person, right? Who you've not slept with before. And thereby you pass the curse onward, right? And then that person becomes the target. Very simple premise. There's a lot of subtext if you want to read into it. People, you know, there are interpretations which say the movie, the creature is referring to STDs, or you pass them on to one another and it never goes away, right? Some STDs are with you for life. So people have said that. People have said it represents the social stigma of premarital sex. Not so much in Western societies maybe, but more so in slightly more conservative ones. So there are different interpretations, different ways in which you can look at what that monster represents. But keeping those, you know, highfalutin philosophical aspects aside, in pure horror aspects, it really works because oftentimes your creatures have some supernatural or, you know, superhuman power to them. And you can always rationalize it in your head. Yeah, you know, they're getting the better of so-and-so because they're able to do this, they're able to teleport. Obviously, the humans don't stand a chance. Here you have a creature that its only power, so to speak, is it can morph its appearance into anyone else's. Other than that, it literally, even when in the movie, when they spot the creature and they start running away from it, the creature doesn't chase them. It still keeps walking at its glacial, you know, like Cubbon Park pace. Like you're taking a stroll, right? It's so the scariness of, or the horror doesn't come from any powers that it has. But the fact that because it can take the form of anyone, it's like anyone, the threat can come from anywhere. I remember one scene very vividly in which the protagonist, I think her name is Jay, she's aware that she's being chased and the monster is close at hand. But obviously she doesn't know what it looks like, and she won't know which among all the people surrounding her, which one is the monster until it comes close enough for her to look at, you know, glean its intention. So there's a scene where you see her point of view, so it's like camera looking at a bunch of people and it's panning slowly, right? So she's like looking around to see which one it is, and it's not just her, it's also you as the viewer looking at, shit, is it that one, is it that one, is it that one? And that scene doesn't resolve that question. So it cuts away, and at a later point in that same scene, you see the creature. So it's just, it leaves you hanging, and you know, you are drawn into, you're not just watching the movie, you're drawn into it as somebody, as an unwilling participant almost, right? So stuff like that, the screenplay and the cinematography have been employed really smartly to make It Follows scary. And just the sheer concept of it, right? Curse being passed on as sex. There is no complexity. It's a very simple premise to understand. So your mental faculties are not wasted in trying to parse unnecessary information. You're hooked into the movie from the get-go. That's the simplicity of the viewing experience, in my view, also adds to the terrifying aspect of it.
Oh, this movie is like a slow burn done right. And it's just, it's terrifying because you don't know who, like you said, you don't know who it is. And there's that one scene on the beach that really messes with me, because I haven't seen this film in quite some time, but if I were to remember it correctly, nobody else can see the demon except the one that is currently looking to possess, right? Yeah. So you can't even tell your friends. I think there's one scene where the girl's hair goes up.
Yeah. And there's this huge guy. Suddenly enters the house. And
that was absolutely terrifying, and it's a great allegory for premarital sex. Basically, that's what it is, right? It's STIs, and just generally the stigma. It's a very warped take on it. Generally, the films that tend to take do a warped take on societal taboos are quite. There's a story there. Like, if you want to write a horror film, take the concept of something that is frowned upon in general society and work with it. Like similarly with Hereditary, right? It's like a family breaking down. What is the worst way that a family can break down? Yeah. You introduce a supernatural element and weave that into the story. Similarly with this, okay, you're sleeping around with a bunch of people. What if they had more consequences than just like an infection? What would the supernatural angle to that be? And it follows plays that perfectly well. I think they greenlit it for a sequel. It's called They Follow. And they've started shooting for it now.
Oh, okay.
10 years later. Right? I mean, it was bound to happen. The movie is...
Sequelitis. We are on sequel episode. We can't judge.
Yeah, but... we can't judge, but yeah, it's bound to happen. A very smart, very simple to understand horror film.
Yeah.
That is somehow, I don't know if we've mentioned this on prior episodes, it's also a great date night episode because it's just one of those weird...
I mean, if you absolutely want to rule out the chance of anything happening, watch this on your date night. Sure, you want to make sure nothing happens, right?
So, yeah.
But yeah, that was my second film. Let's move on to your third one.
We spoke about Scott Derrickson earlier on in this episode when we spoke and when in his film The Exorcism of Emily Rose. And how it was not made onto the list. So I want to talk about, like, I think another film he made in 2012, which for me is genuinely one of the most terrifying films I've seen in my time on Earth.
When you mentioned the movie, I was like, I was mad because like, how did I miss that one? Again, one of
the scariest
movies I've seen. Yeah,
we haven't spoken about it, and this is 2012 Sinister. Directed by Scott Derrickson. Now, the trailer itself is sinister, is supremely scary. The movie more so. And there's it stars Ethan Hawke and Vincent D'Onofrio, I think, two big names in the film. And it tells the story of this writer who moves his family into this old house where there have been prior victims have been murdered in the past, in a bit to inspire him to write his third book or a fourth book. His first novel was a bestseller. I think it's called Kentucky Blood. And then he had two middling attempts after. So he's trying to rediscover that spark. And in that house, in the attic, he discovers a bunch of like these Super 8 films, which turn out to be snuff films, right? Of families that have disappeared throughout the last 40, 50 years. And then the families, they show the families being killed in gruesome fashion. And every time a family was killed, the youngest child in that family went missing. And as he's consuming these films on a nightly basis to give him inspiration, he starts to notice a figure appear in all of those films. And then he consults an occultist. And around the same time, he starts hearing things go bump in the night. And his children start having, like, I think one of his, there's a really terrifying scene of his son who has sleep paralysis or is sleepwalking and has a terrifying nightmare. And his daughter starts seeing this girl around the house. A lot of things happen. There's a great twist in the end. Bagul is the pagan demon that they have unwittingly encountered. And I remember it has one of the greatest twist, because I always wonder, like, you know, there's that twist of when in a bid to escape a haunted house, you do something. This kind of subverts that whole trope. I hope I haven't spoiled the film for most people. But generally, it is atmospheric as hell. It has a like a brief 2-minute clip involving a lawnmower, which fucking terrifies me to this
lawnmower day. Gives me PTSD. Just the word lawnmower, I'm like, oh, fuck, I don't want to think about it.
Because it's like it's in pure silence, right? And it's just like, it's,
oh man, it's so fucking creepy. I don't want to think about it. Just remembering it makes me very uncomfortable.
Fucking Sinister is just it. I remember it was one of the first, like, there are about 5 films that really made me uneasy to go out in the dark in the night to get a glass of water. This is one of them.
Yeah.
And it's like it's really famous people, but. It's you, and you obviously know that it's the whole thing's an act, but still fucking terrifying.
And like when it comes to Sinister, while the main story, the whole Ethan Hawke storyline is terrifying, there are enough jump scares or genuine scares with Bagul and the happenings with the kids. The beauty of the movie is in the snuff films. And like you said, they're silent, so that itself adds to the creep factor. And each of those snuff films, the if I were to call it that, the screenplay or the direction of those snuff films, even within the ecosystem of Sinister, is on a level on apart. Right? It's a class apart. The snuff films themselves are terrifying. And the main movie is really scary. But the snuff, in the, especially the lawnmower one, like, masterful. The one thing that sort of diluted the horror quotient for me, I don't know if you remember this, Abhin. We were in college and I was telling our friend Gagan about this movie. And I was mentioning the name of the antagonist, the pagan demon Bugul. He's like, Bagala? What does Bagal do? And instantly, like, the menace of Bugul halved in my mind, right?
So next Gagan has this insane, he has this insane knack of just like shitting on things without knowing it. And I remember when we went to watch The Dark Knight Rises and the whole Dishe Basarab like chant, right?
Yeah.
He's like, bro, what are they saying? Dashing Pasha. And ever since then, I have been unable to like hear it. Every time I hear Dishe Basara, I think of Dashing Pasha.
But I'm sure
Sinister, if you haven't seen it, like became such a big hit, kind of launched Blumhouse. I think it is a Blumhouse film. This is one of the early Blumhouse movies that really catapulted the studio, and then The Conjuring came after it, and you know, the rest is history.
I think Purge also really helped Blumhouse become big.
Again, Ethan Hawke once more.
And Ethan Hawke has revenue share. I was reading somewhere, he's got revenue share in all of these movies. So he made more than he could have made, you know, with an upfront payment.
Ethan Hawke is...
Coming back. Highly recommend. If you look at its rating, it's probably not super highly rated. It's like 63%. Again, all of the movies you've mentioned so far have all been in the 90s. So, you know, we've been sort of highbrow with our this one. While this one, on the face of it, may not look like as critically acclaimed, but guys, for us, this is as up there as all of the other movies we've discussed so much. I mean, we've discussed so far. Top notch horror, if you ask me.
Yeah.
But yeah,
shall we move on?
Yes. We want to take a bit of a dive in quality with the last film. And while I originally wanted to talk about 13B, the Madhavan movie, which in my opinion is one of the better Bollywood horror films. You know, good structure, a good payoff at the end, solid, you know, start to finish, hooks you. We've already covered it in the plot twist episode, so I don't want to get into it again. For those of you who haven't listened to us talk about 13B, go check out the plot twist episode. But I'm going to talk about Ram Gopal Varma's Bhoot, right? And to my memory, this was the movie that spawned urban legends in theaters, right? I remember when the movie released, people were like, somebody watched it in the theater and died of fright. And, you know, then they're like, six people have died of fright watching this movie so far. Later on, I got to know it was, you know, Hitchcock had done this with Psycho long back. But Bhoot sort of did it for us in India.
And, I mean, it's like The Exorcist, no? Like The Exorcist, I remember
and the in the 70s.
There are people with cameras outside movie theaters just recording their every move. Like, and this woman came out fainted. This pregnant woman apparently miscarried after having watched The Exorcist. This has been going on since the 70s.
Yeah. But coming back to Bhoot, so I think starring Urmila Matondkar, Ajay Devgan, Rati Agni, Fardeen Khan, and... again, very simple story. Ajay Devgan and Urmila Matondkar move into a new house. Strange things start happening. It's almost Paranormal Activity-esque in that sense. Strange things start happening. Urmila Matondkar is more susceptible to, you know, feeling them or, you know, getting a sense of them. She starts acting weird. Ajay Devgan is like, shit, what do I do? Things start getting crazier. Rati Agniotri is this psychic medium that is brought in to diagnose her. And then you kind of find out, you know, stories and unveiled what happened, how Fardeen Khan was, you know, in the mix. Mm. And why is Urmila Matondkar behaving the way she is? In terms of story structure, this is as stereotypical a ghost story as it can be, right? This is the most, like, these are stories that were told around campfires 2,000 years ago, probably, right?
Yeah.
It's a story as old as time. it's the treatment of it. It's the screenplay, the treatment, and more than anything else, Urmila Matondkar's performance that really makes Fucking this movie a watershed moment for Indian horror. In a way, I feel this role suits her brand of acting perfectly because she makes those expressions a lot and quite well. And it doesn't suit when she's in a rom-com. She doesn't fit as much in other genres, if you see. But in yeah. when it's horror, it's her time to shine. Like that, you know, that's when she's at home.
It's the eyes, no, Urmila Matondkar. It's always yeah. just like whenever she plays like the girl, like either the possessed character or the girl interrupted character. I remember Pyar Tune Kya Kiya, which is where she plays this girl who's going through a breakdown.
Crazy.
And yeah, so it's Ek Haseenati being the other one where she's like O3, I mean Urmila Matondkar for it was just born in the wrong era. Like if she was born in the current era of actresses, she'd be wiping the floor with the competition. She's absolutely one of the more talented actresses to have come out in an era where talented actresses were very around, but they were just, the roles weren't written for them. They just unfortunately yeah. had to conform to whatever society was going through at the time. The lasting legacy of this film for me particularly was the number of horror films it spawned.
Yeah.
In the next couple of years, a lot of it kind of revitalized Indian horror, which had taken a bit of a beating thanks to the Ramsey brothers' camp aesthetic. So when Booth came through, it kind of brought back that whole black magic, occult, supernatural situation. And for a few years, that they started revisiting that formula. I think soon after Booth, or around the same time, because Raaz also had come up around the same time, mm-hmm. 2003, which is like a remake of What Lies Beneath. Generally, those films started coming back to the fore. They became hits. Those were the reasons people were going to movie theaters. And I remember Booth, to this day, people talk about that whole sequence where she first investigates the bump in the night and how well it's done. And people still talk. You spoke about the screenplay and the treatment of the scene. It may not have aged well right now in terms, because it's 2003, and generally 2003 films, like the mid-2000 Bollywood films don't tend to look too great now in the current landscape. Mm. But that one particular scene, the first big scare that happens still sticks in the memory because it was very well done. Ram Gopal Varma, before he went mad, was a director who knew what to do. And I think eventually, as films do, they always tend to tip the directors over the edge. And he's been an unfortunate victim of circumstance.
Yeah. Quick correction. I think the medium they call is Rekha, not Rati Agnihotri. Rati Agnihotri is there in some other film. I remember she was playing this medium character. But in this one, it's Rekha. My bad. Mm. But yeah, like you rightly said, it was a bunch of like serendipitous things coming together. The horror genre hadn't had a good script or a good, you know, a movie put out in a while. People were hungry for something like this. This and Raaz showed that there were viewers for it. Ram Gopal Varma, more often than not, misses it. But when he hits, he really hits it. We've got Satya, yeah. We've got Rangila, we've got... You know, his filmography is great, although it's literally diamonds in a lot of rough. So he got it right with Booth. So a lot of things came together, but unforgettable viewing experience at the other end of it.
Yeah. Well, that's that. Any closing thoughts? Anything else you want to add before we call the episode?
No. I mean, like I said, I'm a little more out of touch with horror than I was a couple of years ago. Stuff like, you know, a couple of good movies that have come out in the last couple of years I've not been on top of. But it's nice to go down this lane because it takes me back to what was probably my golden era of film watching, right? 2012 to 2018, I think I've watched on average 100 films a year. So obviously now today that is not possible.
Yeah.
If I'm able to watch say 20 films a year or 25, I consider myself lucky. But
I know, and I know exactly the feeling. And we run a film podcast. I think the podcast helps push us in the direction because they're like, okay, we need to consume content.
but it's nice to go down that road.
Yeah, I think I agree with you for the most part. I mean, generally I do. I tend to like, we've been always been talking about how we consume stuff that we're familiar with. So our knack of exploring new films is kind of taken a bit of a hit. But
yeah,
given that we do this and there's still a great love and medium for it. So, I mean, love and passion because for the medium. So it'll like, it's a dip, right? Peaks and troughs. Maybe we're in a point where we're not consuming as much, but we're consuming good stuff.
Yeah, Jesus, Abhin, you're melting.
I know, dude. It's fucking hot.
Yeah. But you're on top floor, no? It's all that wooden. Yeah. It cannot be good for you.
Sorry, guys. I apologize for the heat. It is so hot.
Let us put you out of your misery. Was us. That was this episode. As usual, we don't know what we're going to talk about next week.
It'll be a single film the next time, I assure you.
Yes, we're going back to our single film for next couple of episodes. But yes. Until then, that's us. See you. Goodbye.
Bye.